Singapore-based Alan Law is a third-generation member of a prominent Hong Kong business family whose intergenerational philosophy is one of one family member in one business unit. This led him to found Park Hotel Group at the age of 23, which he has built into a regional hospitality powerhouse. Upon turning 40, he sought to infuse social purpose into his evolving business and investment activities. And today, he is on a global mission to extend the human health span. In early 2025, he launched and funded a new $70 million VC fund. In August 2025, Alan Law committed a further $156 million to launch Morrow, a chain of lifestyle medical centres at the heart of a newly emerging global longevity economy, which UBS reports could be worth $8 trillion by 2030. Alan Law, welcome to Wealth Office. UBS recently published a report citing three segments of economic activity that will drive equity markets for the next 10 years. One was power, one, unsurprisingly, was artificial intelligence, and the third was longevity. Why, in your view, is longevity such a transformational opportunity over the next 10 years?
Yes, indeed. It was quite surprising to me as well. I didn't expect longevity to be as big as AI as we move along the next decade. But as I read the research report from UBS stating that by 2030, the longevity industry will be about a US $8 trillion market. So it is huge. And I can understand further why it is potentially so big. So one side you have your healthcare system, which require much needed transition from currently pretty much heavy sick care operation to one that is shifting more towards diagnostic and preventive care model. So that itself is one gigantic opportunity. And then the other side, you have aging population, whereby some may need assisted living. So on its own, is also a assisted living kind of model is another huge opportunity for longevity as well. Ultimately, I think in longevity industry, what we are trying to achieve is that the current gap between lifespan and health span, according to WHO, is about 9 years across the globe. And many people are trying actually to find ways to bridging that gap. And that itself is literally what is driving what longevity industry to be as fast as AI.
You know, it's quite surprising. I was looking at a graph recently that tracks life expectancy, which is going up unsurprisingly all over the world. And when you talk about health span, you're talking about that portion of life where we are going to perhaps be not healthy. And as you say, the last 9 to 10 years at the moment, most people won't live in perfect health. That's a long time. Even as life expectancy is rising, the health span is not changing. That gap is persisting. So people may be encountering chronic illness, for example, later in life than before.
Yes.
But it's still that last 10 years. It's quite a pervasive thing to challenge. But for me, the sustainable healthcare piece seems so self-evident as an opportunity that no matter where you are in the world, if you're in socialized medicine or if you're in a non-socialized medical system, what's really clear is almost no medical system is financially sustainable. And if you forecast demographics, none are sustainable.
Yes, indeed.
For the next decades.
Yeah, so there are many research out there showing that actually most countries who, if they continue the current model, they'll go bankrupt. They cannot sustain. As you rightly point out, your age are expected to be longer, but then your requirement to have this healthcare support are actually expected to be even longer because your health span doesn't move. So you just have longer years in poor health. In that sense. And of course, medical expenditure going up annually and people expecting better healthcare as well. So all these healthcare costs will just balloon up And that's why there's a huge push to a lot of countries about shifting the focus to preventive care. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're trying to do with Morrow as well.
We're going to come on to Morrow in just a moment, but it seems so obvious, doesn't it, that seems so strange that we don't already have a system that seeks to detect early and deal with root cause. It seems bizarre that the world tends to have a healthcare system based on treating the symptoms when it's already too late, which is self-evidently expensive. It's a bizarre.
Yeah.
Why do you think now is the moment? Is it technology? Is it AI? Why is now the moment for that transition, do you think?
Yeah, so it has started decades ago. It's literally a healthcare system asking you to, if you are not sick, don't come and see us.
Yes.
Right. So if you're sick, come and treat the symptoms. Yes. I give you whether it's a treatment plan, or I give you a bag of medicine and go home. If you finish it and you feel good, don't come back.
Yes.
That's the current healthcare system, which has been there for decades. Why now about preventive healthcare? I think it's kind of started shortly after COVID. Mm. I think a lot of people are seeing health is very critical, and not just physical health, but including mental health as well. Mm. And after the COVID hit the world, people are putting a lot more focus in their health, and people are asking, how do I prevent catching some of these diseases in the future, whether it's COVID or blood flu or other disease, and many are, for example, like chronic diseases, your diabetes, your cancer. People want to find out how can they prevent as much as possible falling sick. None of us want to spend our last 10 years in sickbed, right?
Yes.
So the model of preventive healthcare is that if you start taking care of yourself, and put on a healthy lifestyle early, then potentially you can actually avoid or mitigate some of these health risks down the road as well. So, and then coming to the economic front is that, as mentioned just now, was literally if the country continue their projectile of what they are seeing of longer healthcare required per capita, and the healthcare cost per capita are going up, the country cannot afford. Mm-hmm. Are you going to continue increase tax for this? It's not possible. So basically, it is it's a two-way direction. One is a social front, and one is an economic front that pushes government to literally reconsider the existing healthcare infrastructure and model.
And there's obviously a substantial business financial opportunity here as well. You are investing $156 million or thereabouts in launching Morrow. Morrow is hopefully going to be an international series of centres with a focus on wellness and longevity. What for you is the vision for Morrow? How do you see that playing out over those next 10 years, for example?
Yeah, so as mentioned, what we're seeing in the bigger picture is that the opportunities are there, as highlighted by, let's say, the UBS report. The research also show most countries need to pivot with their healthcare system. But what we see on the ground is that not many countries are moving fast enough. Mm-hmm. And because each country, they have constraint with their existing healthcare model. If you say, I want to do more health, preventive healthcare, does it mean that I have to do less sick care?
Yes.
Right? So, or can I add additional increase of my resources to do extra? So I think most countries faces that dilemma and couldn't move fast enough.
Yes.
For example, Singapore, they are trying to put some small investment into preventive healthcare in the recent years, and it's driving awareness for the country, but I think mass adoption is still not there. But what we see is that as a private sector, we can actually move quite fast ourselves. So that's why we have decided that, okay, instead of waiting for the government to act, how do we seize this opportunity and establish a proof of concept model for others to follow, and to also to nudge the government to increase their investment in the preventive care model as well. Once that investment in preventive healthcare works, basically it'll trim down a lot on your future expenditure on sick care. So until that moment, the country don't start seriously investing in preventive, their healthcare costs will continue to rise. So I think this is kind of the tipping point where a lot of countries are looking at it. And for Singapore, for example, is also named one of the blue zone in the world. But yet, for Singapore data itself, it shows there's a good 10 years gap between health span and life span currently. Despite, as you mentioned, the life expectancy have grown throughout the years, but 10 years is a long time to be in poor health and requiring that sick care or assisted living for the individuals. And even there are various surveys asking people, would you want to live longer? Actually, to a surprising, more than half say, actually, I don't want to live longer based on those surveys.
They just want to live healthier for their life.
Yeah, so, but then the second question to the survey is that, would you want to live longer if it is given that you'll be healthy during those extended years?
Yes.
Then almost 100% will say, yes, I want it.
Of course.
So it's literally, it's not about how long you live, it's about how healthy you can live your life and fulfill that purpose in life. Yeah.
There's an interesting piece in the Morrow proposition. And actually there was one of the longevity websites I saw talked about Morrow as a vital bridge in this longevity revolution. And that there's a lot of science, there's a lot of technology that's coming to a maturity that means it can be deployed. Mm. But actually there's not that much infrastructure in terms of taking that to the masses at the moment. And what I think is also interesting about Morrow is this kind of creed of personal responsibility. So I've seen it described as, you know, fitness is one of the pillars of longevity, and most people, not all, but most people will have a gym membership or a yoga membership. So they tend to invest in their fitness, but there are five or six other areas they don't invest in, which are relevant to that later life. And actually, you could be incredibly physically fit, but you could be missing out on many things that will close that health span, which I think a lot of people don't quite understand. And that was quite a revelation to me when I read through that.
Yeah, so at Morrow, we adopt what you call the Lifestyle Medicine Foundation. And there's six key pillars. Yes, you point out the physical activity is one of the important ones. Mm-hmm. Then you have nutrition and diet is next. So if you don't eat well, you can't expect to have a healthy life, because we almost like you are what you eat, right? So then there's about sleep, how well you sleep. But then which actually a lot of people want to sleep well, but they have difficulty. Why? Because it's going to the next key pillar is actually about stress management.
Yes.
If you're so stressful, how do you expect to sleep well?
Yes.
Yeah, right. So a lot of things, all these pillars are linked. And then the last two is actually avoid harmful substances. If you are smoking, drinking heavily, do you expect to have good health? It's almost impossible.
Yes.
And then last is having a positive social connection. That is more on the mental health and that social support, that social interaction is actually a very important part. A lot of people actually don't recognize it. I think the silver lining from COVID is that people now recognize, I've been in isolation, in solitation, and now I see so important that my relationship with your friends and family are so critical to one's mental health.
Yeah. Yes. If you look at the Blue Zone data, and I know some people have questioned the Blue Zone data, but those social relationships are really key to it in so many ways. I want to talk a little bit about Asia, because one of the striking things about this longevity revolution, as you've cited already, UBS say 8 trillion revolution over the next 10 years.
Yes.
That's substantive.
Yes.
It's very much an Asia-led revolution. Now, I think it's unfair to say it's Asia-led because it's longevity. And actually,
One of the things that I encounter in my company day to day is this, what I often think of as the Asian wealth tsunami. So bear with me here, but there are so many multi-generational families and businesses who have done incredibly well for 10, 20 years off the phenomenal economic growth in mainland China, Singapore, Hong Kong, many parts of Asia. And actually, they've got to a point that they've generated substantial holdings, substantial wealth. Maybe some of those economies have slowed down, but in every case, most of those families I find now are looking much more globally at their opportunities. And one of the things that I think is underreported is the level of ambition coming out of that part of the world and the level of resource available for entrepreneurs and families from that part of the world to really lead these transformational opportunities, be it AI or be it longevity. You know, there's 20 different categories we could talk about. What's your view on this kind of Asian wealth tsunami? How do you see the world playing out in the next few years?
Yes. So obviously, the global economy have seen Asian wealth and economy grow throughout the last couple of decades, and a lot of wealth have been built. And in Asian culture, I think a lot of us are thinking of how can we give back to the society, mm-hmm. and what impact can we cause other than just creating wealth? What better use can we do with our wealth? I think a lot of family offices and people I spoke to actually have similar ideas as to beyond the dollar and cents, what can we do with the wealth created, right?
Yes.
So I think I wouldn't just say it is from Asia, but there's a lot of these thinking behind that, and in particular, healthcare or longevity area is probably one of the top three area of impact that most Asian company, Asia family. Yes. Would want to get involved. The other one is probably education. Mm-hmm. So education and healthcare is definitely something that very close to most families in Asia, especially those generation who have seen the wars and the poor of Asia a few decades ago, and to where Asia is now is actually transformative.
Yes.
And many of us would want to give back to the society, not necessarily just Asia, but how do we influence on a global stand as well? Just for example, on longevity alone, there are research showing US being the top economy, they spend the most in healthcare system, but guess what? They rank very low in their health.
For outcomes, I think I've seen that outcome. Data.
Yeah, so it's scary, right? You can spend a lot, but you don't get outcome for your the individual's health. So that is extremely scary. And I think from an Asia perspective is, we even thinking out loud as to that potentially can be a big revolutionary change opportunity.
Yes.
Because you are spending and you cannot create a positive outcome. In the question is, how can we transform that spending into something that actually have positive outcome to our individual health?
Yeah? Yes, I think what a lot of the Western, let's say Western media rather than Western world, because I think Western world and social media, I mean, the world is quite visible at this point, but media tends to be quite nationalistic. So it's hard to get the true picture. But what I think, again, is very underappreciated is just the level of ambition that is coming from the region. Longevity is a classic example. But if we look another way, so 2 weeks ago, I was at Oxford University. I was at the business school there. I was very delighted to be invited to go and speak to a group of 30, 20-something year olds who've been flown in from Vietnam, from Hong Kong, from Singapore, from mainland China, all over the region. All of them came from family businesses. And each and every one of them, despite being in their early 20s, were thinking about their leadership journey. Mm. And it was either, am I going into the family business? In which case, what impact will I have?
Yeah.
Or do I take the resources of the family and do I diversify into something else?
Yes.
But in every case, the level of ambition by default was tremendous. And you're absolutely right. It was about impact. It wasn't, it was not about wealth. And I think this actually is very misunderstood in the family office conversations that happen. Mm. I think a lot of family office conversations are focused on finances and numbers. Yes. Yes. And actually, in my experience, mm-hmm. you know, my entire company deals with ultra high net worth individuals yes. all the time. It's diminishing returns when you are just chasing numbers.
Yes.
And it starts to very quickly become, what is it I'm doing in the world? What's my life worth?
Yes.
And what can I turn that yes. into in terms of actual impact? But one thing that always strikes me in particular, and I keep returning to Asia, I don't want to pigeonhole you here, but it's a fascinating subject. Intergenerational business transformation. Mm. I find in the West in particular, the focus is on preservation by not changing.
Yes, yes.
And I think that seems completely wrong for the modern world. If you look at other parts of the world, the focus is on each generation adding something new.
Yes.
So in your case, we won't go into details, but you know your family's legacy starts with garments, moves into real estate.
Yes.
You pivot into hospitality, then into fitness, and now into longevity.
Yes.
Where do you think that comes from? Why is the impetus so towards, let's not say it's not cautious, there is preservation still there, but why is it so focused on what's next, what's bigger, what's better?
Yeah, so I think a lot of family with a couple of generation behind them are kind of definitely focusing on wealth preservation. Mm-hmm. They don't want the wealth kind of die in their hands, right, in that certain particular generation. And sometimes it's also how the first generation kind of set up their whether it's a foundation or estate management, etc. So ultimately, some I understand the older model was that, you put all the wealth in one vehicle and then nominate family members inside to kind of have some form of voting rights and all that to manage the family wealth. Typically, those set up are very conservative and end up almost like put in some investment grade type of investment, just take yes. dividends out and pass it and share in the generation to come, so that everyone's still well off, but no one actually have a chunk of money to do big investment and big move yes. in the market.
So it feels to me like that has almost gone at this point.
Yeah, so many family end up in that way. But for us, especially for my family, we are quite progressive in that sense. The family have one philosophy. It believes that only one family member in one business unit.
Yes.
So my grandfather is the first generation, then my father generation is six of them.
Yes.
And then by the time come to my generation, there are 20 of us.
Right.
And I couldn't count the next generation already, assuming two each, we'll have 40 already in the next generation. So if we are following the family philosophy of one family member mm-hmm. in one business unit, we actually need many business units. Yeah, so that's also how we start venturing out from what we call maybe a mothership, for example, when my grandfather first started his garment manufacturing. And then my father's generation kind of branch out to real estate. Yes. And then for myself, I start branching out from hotel. Mm-hmm. And then now in wellness, fitness, longevity. It's that entrepreneur spirit and that family philosophy that keep our toes on the ground, at the same time preserving wealth, but how do we grow wealth at the same time creating impact in the society? I think if you can find this three-way approach mm-hmm. To your investment, that's the best. Yeah.
I want to talk about that a little bit. Actually, I want to give you a bit more credence for your own journey as well, because you were 23 when you landed in the hotel business with your first hotel, and I read that you worked every role available to learn that business as quickly as possible. So I'd love just to hear a little bit about that. But in particular, what's quite striking is your pivot into fitness is very much driven by purpose. I mean, clearly there's an investment philosophy as well. But can you just tell me a bit about your journey to really getting to that point that purpose became so important in your activities? I guess, first of all, maybe if we start with the hotel, I mean, tell me a bit about being 23 and landing with a hotel and ambitions to grow that into something.
Yeah, it was, I call myself accidental hotelier. So I was 23, I was still studying in London, university in mathematics major. That was the year where SARS was striking in Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. And this particular hotel in the heart of Tsim Sha Tsui was being foreclosed by the bank. Mm-hmm. And my family just thought it is a cheap real estate. Yes. And they bought it and then the moment they secured the deal, my father gave me a call and said, we have no intention of learning how to run a hotel. It's down to the next generation to pick this up. So at that point in time, it's like, should I go back to Hong Kong or should I stay in London after I graduate? That was still the dilemma. But then with my dad's call, I've decided that I'll take up the opportunities and learn whatever I can. So that's how I started. Took the next flight out and jumped into the hotel and start doing all the jobs within the hotel, literally.
Park Hotel Group today is, you know, it's a very admirable regional player in luxury hospitality and many other areas as well.
Yes.
How do you then come to your pivot into fitness?
Yes.
That's quite fascinating because it strikes me as that's when purpose really started to enter the equation.
Yeah. So I've been growing the hotel group from one single hotel in Hong Kong to a regional hotel chain in Asia, from China, Japan, Singapore and the Maldives. So we have reached a point whereby I've established a very loyal team with me, and I see myself able to let go more, almost like not requiring 100% of my focus in the hotel business. And that's when I see myself and say, okay, now I have some time on my hand, what can I do with it?
Yes.
So I go back to my family philosophy. It's time to start a new business because yes. We want more business unit in years to come. So, and then I ask myself, if I were to start a new business today, what would it be? And wellness and fitness is the one that has come into my mind. In the hotel industry, we do some form of wellness program, fitness program within our hotel and resorts. So we for sure have a gym, a pool, and some healthy dining options already. So I'm it's not unfamiliar with me, but it's always been a very small portion of the hotel business. Mm. So then I've decided, okay, how can I make it a standalone business and to grow on its own right? So yes. That's when I co-founded Move Repeat. And now we have three brands under Move Repeat: Yoga Movement, Strong Pilates, and Revel Training.
Yes. Yeah. If you look at those brands, and I won't cite the statistics because the growth is so fast that it will make this video out of date really quickly if I do, but suffice to say that the level of global ambition and the growth rate in all of those fitness companies you have is tremendous and really speaks to that kind of ambition we were talking about earlier. And actually, more recently, that's also been manifest in Savino Capital. So this year, you launched Savino Capital. Yes. It's a VC fund focused on early and growth stage ventures, which can impact the human health span. And yes. there's two things about that which are really interesting to me. And actually, a few years ago, I was involved in an AI fund. It was $100 million AI fund, and it didn't focus on AI products, but it focused on the component technologies of the AI revolution. And it strikes me Savino is very similar and that there is a longevity in a wellness revolution, but with anything that's new, you need new innovations, new technologies. And that, I gather, is where the focus of Savino is.
Yes, so we see a lot of funding gaps in this particular area of longevity, human health span, and especially in Asia. So we have decided to set up this venture, Savino Capital, to exactly do that, to help founders and early stage company to be able to get that funding for them to scale and to cause this positive impact to human health span. Yes. So as you rightly point out, the industry is so wide and bought, and at the same time, it's still evolving pretty much. Yes. And there's no one solution is the only solution that is going to corner the market. But I think it is about putting the bets in different pockets of the longevity industry, and betting on the right funders and ideas, and helping them to scale, is the approach where we take from Sivano Capital.
I want to return a little bit to the family office conversation. Thinking about your own journey, your own interests, and even looking at Sivano, I think one of the things I saw on the Sivano website is part of what you are offering is not just capital, but it's the network, it's the ecosystem that these ventures can plug into in addition to capital. Let's call it intellectual capital, which for me speaks to a lot of what family businesses or family offices, if you want to look at it that way, really look to bring now, which is, it's very bespoke, but it's about what can we bring beyond
money.
Your money, of essentially.
But
also, when I look at, again, the family office conversation, I find so much of the family office or the family business conversation, it tends to be dominated by big banks, and they want to talk about asset allocation, they want to talk about financial products. So I just wonder, from your perspective as, you know, the end customer to some of these people, how do you reconcile the family ambition for being very bespoke, very entrepreneurial, very intellectual capital driven with the world of advisors who can be extremely institutionalized in their thinking?
Yes.
What's your view?
Yeah, so we definitely have a portion of our wealth in some form of this kind of traditional setup, in about asset allocation, diversification, and all that. So we do have a portion of that, but we also set aside a pool of funds solely for entrepreneurial spirit type of investment. So for things that may not be proven successful, for things that is a totally startup, and we will put money behind it, because we know a portion of it is on the safer note. The other portion, we actually can take higher risk if you're looking at it as a balanced portfolio, right? So we have something safe, something more risky, but on the balance, we're actually driving what we call a risk and balance approach, type of a return.
Risk and balance. So there's still an element of requiring that institutionalized safe. It's very much about diversification in terms of where
you place. It's taking calculated risk. I think for entrepreneur, we believe whatever we do will have risk. Mm-hmm. Is that calculated risk worth taking? And what is that potential upside and return you can get? Mm-hmm. And some may be monetary upside, some may be actually that impact and financially kind of a concept as an upside as well. So sometimes we see things may not be the best investment, but we potentially can help many people. Mm-hmm. That may take off other boxes. And for Sivano itself, we set aside another bucket for it for some of these founders and early investor type of VC investments.
As I was saying, that's very much the trend that I see with the clients I work with. So, you know, we're sat in London today, but my firm, most of our clients are mainland China, Hong Kong, Singapore, Taiwan, Korea. And it's the same model each time. It's as you say, it's that risk and opportunity approach with a little bit of vanilla. But most of them place their risk, I would say, on the global expansion piece.
Yes.
Leaning into these new verticals. And the reason I'm talking about that is thinking about some of the audience that watch this video, it feels like the world's in this incredible moment of change, which can feel very scary to some people. If you look at political headlines, it can feel extremely scary. But if you forget the headlines and look at the trend lines, it feels like there's a lot of opportunity. And I'm interested in, especially from your role at Sivano, but also more generally as an investor and entrepreneur, what advice would you give perhaps to a younger entrepreneur right now, looking at the level of opportunity in the world? What would you advise them to do, to be looking at? How should they be behaving in the world? Do you think it's a time of more opportunity or less because the barriers feel higher to entry sometimes?
Yeah, so if you look at opportunity today, actually funding is not the difficult part nowadays. There's many options in funding. It's whether you have the right idea, right concept, and the execution plan. And of course, at times you need a bit of a good network and a bit of luck as well.
Yes.
So but as an entrepreneur or as a founder, I think if we keep our big picture about solving a world problem and giving that as a starting point, and if we have a solution for that world problem, I don't see limitation to funding nor the limitation to growth beyond certain border because of political risk, for example. So I think focus on the impact we're going to cause, the end consumer benefit to them.
Yes.
And ultimately, the countries, the political leaders are also mostly voted by their citizens also. So if the end user, the majority of the population believe that something is working out for them, they will continue to consume in that area, and ultimately you will start pushing boundary and shifting rules and regulations even to that extent. So I wouldn't say that, that these are actually limitation in the longer run. It may be current day is you see as a roadblock, but then the question is, how can I remove that roadblock? Instead of just taking, accepting this roadblock and then I just give up in my venture, for example. So I think it's literally having that entrepreneurial spirit, focusing on the big problem to solve, and if we have a good solution for it, just push hard. We'll for sure face challenges, but the question is, how do we overcome that? It is going to be critical. And for most founder and entrepreneur, if you ask all the successful ones, they will say, yes, today you see me very successful, but actually I have actually fall and make so many mistakes along the way.
Yes.
But I picked myself up and I got stronger. That's how ultimately a successful business or a successful entrepreneur end up to be.
Do you think the role of family is sometimes underestimated in business? As you talk about, I think every entrepreneurial journey involves disappointment, failure, mistakes. And I know in my own journey, I had one particular huge failure, which impacted me greatly at the time, but today I draw great strength and lessons from it. And that's part of the journey. But I often think family businesses, you are bound together by something stronger, which to me adds resilience. Maybe that underlies some of the ambition that we've talked about. Do you think family is a good structure for business, or is the world beyond that at this point?
I think there's family office, there's pros and cons. There is certain so-called obligation in the family that drives individuals maybe at the starting point.
Yes.
But whether that drives the individual in the longer run, not necessary. Being in the family office, again, because of the extensive network and connection that you have, you open doors.
Yes.
That makes things a lot easier to start with as well. But how far those take is depending on the project or on the family as well. So to me, there's definitely a lot of upside in the beginning in the family setting. But then on the longer run, depends whether the family dynamic are on the same page on the risk reward approach that you're taking. Is every family member are supporting you and buying into that, or actually there's a diverged opinion within the family about what you're trying to achieve, then that may become a hindrance at times, because there's no one sure win road to success, right? So until we continue our strive into that journey, no one is going to say for sure this is going to be a rewarding one or it's going to be a failure.
Yes.
Until you walk down that journey. So so that can be a hindrance, depends on each family's support in that area. But if you are 100% on your own, self-funding entrepreneur and founders, you may be funding through some form of institutional money or some kind of a VC fund structure, etc. Those who also have its own pros and cons. Yes, you don't have the family baggage or support behind you, but then you are constantly being pushed by these external investors. You must grow so fast. I must exit in a certain number of years. If not, my IRR is going to drop, etc. So it's like driving you beyond your comfort level at times. Mm-hmm. So whether that's the best for the organization, not sure. But if you can balance that, I think both have its pros and cons.
Alan Law, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for joining me for Wealth Office.
Oh, thank you, Michael. Thank you for having me.